Our next presenter, Roberta Freund-Schwartz, is an associate professor of historical musicology at the University of Kansas and advising director of the University of Kansas Archive of Recorded Sound. Her areas of specialization include the music of the Spanish Renaissance and African-American popular music. She has produced articles on various Renaissance and blues subjects, and she is a contributor to many rock history textbooks. Her monograph, How Britain Got the Blues, published by Ashgate in 2007, won an ARSC Award for Excellence in Historical Writing on the Blues. She is currently working on a book about the city blues of the 1930s. Roberta is also currently co-chair of the ARSC Awards for Excellence Committee. Her presentation today is titled, From Blue Horizon to Sadisk, Independent Record Labels in the British Blues Revival. Won't you give a warm welcome to Roberta Freund-Schwartz.
Hi, talk about tough acts to follow, but... The blues revival in the 1960s created a widespread demand for blues recordings. In addition to jazz and blues aficionados, a 1964 Melody Maker survey revealed that 41% of beat and rock album buyers also occasionally purchased blues records. Major labels and import distributorships offered discs to this expanding market, but focused on certain popular styles and artists. So connoisseurs, interested in a wider variety of material, took matters into their own hands and started record labels. To be sure, not a unique phenomenon. Independent labels have arisen to serve niche markets as long as there have been records and niches. But several things make the British blues indies a little bit different. First, the minuscule size of the niche. Second, their apparent disregard for success. And three, the ephemeral nature of the labels, the exceptionally ephemeral nature. Dozens of British musicians and collectors founded labels. Most only issued a handful of recordings, making the turbulent independent blues record scene an ever-changing kaleidoscope of labels with colorful names, shadowy origins, lofty goals, and usually anonymous founders. The demand for blues records in Britain had been growing for a decade, and many labels were already in the game. Decca was recognized for their commitment to the genre, and you can tell because they have a little blues song that's a Decca ad there up at the top. And they also employed a resident blues producer named Mike Vernon. Beginning in the late 1950s, Decca and its London subsidiary released newly recorded material by bluesmen touring in England, as well as back catalogs from the Imperial, Atlantic, and Victor catalogs, including Alan Lomax's Southern Folk Heritage series. It also released Out Came the Blues, which included country, classic, and down-home blues, and the RCA Victor Race series, which dipped into the American Decca, Brunswick, and Vocalion catalogs, including the Kings of the Blues under the name of Alexis Corner, one of the founders of the British blues revival. In an attempt to dominate the burgeoning market, EMI-affiliated Stateside released a torrent of albums by John Lee Hooker, Jimmy Reed, and Lightnin' Hopkins from the Excello and VJ catalogs. British Columbia focused on recording visiting blues singers in their London studios and American R&B from the 50s. Mercury reissued some of its older recordings by Josh White and Big Bill Brunzi, who were huge in Britain. Fontana and its parent label, Philips, released compilations of early blues in their Treasures of North American Negro Music series, as well as new and nearly new material by well-known artists. So not only were the majors already putting out blues records, there was an established layer of independents also releasing blues in Britain. Pye, which started as an independent concern in 1953, became a major label by leasing masters from the Chess and King labels, just in time for the beginning of both rock and roll and the British R&B movement. British Vogue was started to supply pre-war R&B to England. Ember offered a variety of blues material. Jazz Collector was obviously started to provide early jazz reissues to trad fans, but it also supplied early blues in its Male Blues Singer series. In 1953, Tony Standish, who was a writer for Jazz Journal, launched Heritage Records to distribute field recordings and compilations of vintage blues. Doug Dobell, who ran one of London's most esteemed and probably largest jazz and blues record store, started his 77 label for similar reasons, but with a focus on folk blues. And then, of course, there were imports. Both of the original recordings and historical compilations by labels like Yazoo, Our Holy, and Origin Jazz Library. However, that still left parts of the market neglected. Chicago blues, folk blues, and what they were calling soul blues, sort of B.B. King, urban blues, were in plentiful supply. There was also reissued material from the early years of the blues available, but really only by a very limited number of artists. Many of the blues cognoscenti felt that, quote, the task of continuing the blues tradition rests firmly in the hands of the independent labels, unquote. Most of the small labels reissuing rarities and records outside the mainstream were labors of love rather than serious commercial enterprises. Their limited edition discs were marketed directly to the target audience, and despite their high cost, about three times more than a pop album, label owners rarely did more than break even. Based on available evidence, very few of them seemed to aspire to anything more. In contrast to earlier independent labels, which at least sent a press release around to the trades announcing the formation of a new concern, as did Pi and Ember, ads for independently produced discs in the 1960s just appeared in journals like Blues Unlimited and R&B Monthly. Sometimes they provided a track listing, sometimes only a record's title. Sometimes a governing philosophy, like the best of post-war blues, was articulated as well. The only standard information was a catalog number, a price, and an address. The name of the proprietor was normally absent, and occasionally, so was the name of the label. This, to me, is one of the most intriguing aspects of the independent blues scene in Britain, the almost furtive nature of many of the concerns. Founders were rarely identified. Labels changed names with no prior notice and often for no logical or apparent reason. And no label releases were not uncommon. It's not entirely clear why there was such a focus on anonymity. Passions ran high among British blues fans, so it's possible that no one wanted to be pilloried in press or called in the middle of the night because this or that artist was or was not included on a given disc. And yes, it did happen. Mike Vernon, the very public face of Blue Horizon Records, was lambasted for recording British blues and R&B artists after claiming that his goal was, quote, to make sure that the music that is issued on record is genuine and not some phony copy, unquote. Which is how most British blues was regarded, as phony copies. The sometimes dubious status of proper licenses might have been a concern. While many labels licensed material from American record companies, a goodly number of their reissues were bootlegs, illegally dubbed from rare 78s owned by British collectors. The vast majority of European revivalists weren't really sympathetic to the complaints of record labels, as they knew that most of the blues musicians had made the records for flat fees and weren't going to receive residuals anyway. Most likely, though, it was to avoid the appearance of conflict of interest. The inner circle of the blues intelligentsia was fairly small. Chances are, if you were passionate enough to start a label, you were either running a blues journal or you were writing for one. Therefore, your publication was probably either reviewing your own releases or those of your competitors. For example, it would have been hard for Ian A. Anderson, not the Jethro Tull Ian Anderson, different one. As one of the faces behind the British country blues movement, it would have been hard for him to distance himself from Matchbox, which he founded while writing about new British blues releases in his column in Blues Unlimited. Easier just to list a postal address in your ad and keep them up. Another example is bootleg. A limited edition operation formed in 1964 with the, quote, sole purpose of offering British blues aficionados, quote, some of the finest and rarest and great down-home blues. The advertisement in Blues Unlimited described the founders as, quote, a group of philanthropic and knowledgeable collectors, though declined to mention that said philanthropists were editor Simon Napier and staff writer Mike Rowe. Bootleg did release several singers that were paradoxically not bootlegged. Rather, they were licensed reissues from the Parrot, Bluestown, and Modern labels. Bootleg's promised collection of previously unreleased material from the border states never materialized, at least not on the bootleg label. In 1965, a new label, PWB, for post-war blues, surfaced, and its first release, Hobos and Drifters, contained unissued songs by three unknown blues men from California and Michigan, and unlike any other PWB record, has the catalog number BRL100, probably for bootleg record label, even though there's no other connection between these two labels except for Mike Rowe, who also imported singles directly from America from the Detroit-based Fortune label and its subsidiaries. PWB, and you can see these all have catalog numbers PWB, issued geographically focused compilations of rare post-war material with excellent notes. Though it only put out 5 albums, they're still sought by collectors. Now, Rowe wasn't the only import distributor to eventually start his own label. Chris Johnson, best known as the founder of Island Records, served as a distributor before launching Sue UK, which issued 45s with material from Elmore James, Willie Maybon, J.B. Lenore, and B.B. King. Nat Joseph began Transatlantic Records in 1961 as an importer and distributor of American folk, blues, and jazz collections. Several years later, he added new material to his catalog, primarily British folk blues, by artists like Ralph McTell and John Renborn. When the Prestige and Bluesville's labels failed, Transatlantic acquired their catalogs and issued them under their own imprint and their Extra Budget subsidiary. Extra was also employed for the release of The Mike Raven Show. Raven was a disc jockey who ran Britain's first all-blues show, first on a small pirate radio station and then on the BBC One. The disc, which featured tracks from other Extra collections, was a sampler, quote, meant primarily for people first coming to the blues who are still rather wondering just what it is all about, unquote. Its success stimulated a similar outreach album, which is the one pictured here, that demonstrated different styles of blues for the neophyte. The focus of many of the independent reissue labels was the immediate post-war period that by that time was recognized as a golden age of the Chicago blues. Singles and albums from the period, particularly those recorded for small local concerns, were becoming, as Paul Oliver noted, quote, as scarce and obscure as ever were the vocalions of the 20s. Nashua Records was started in 1966 by John Allison, who started out importing American specialist labels. He aimed to make, quote, the finest, rarest post-war blues from below the Mason-Dixon line, unquote, available to the public. However, the label issued only one album, Let's Go Down South, Post-War Blues as Sung from Memphis Down to Dallas. The Manchester-based Kokomo and Highway 51 labels, run by Trev Hoyden, Ted Griffiths, and Bob Groom, fared modestly better. Highway 51 and its predecessor, Blue Highway, which I'm not sure ever released a disc, issued several compilations of post-war items that were well-received despite an early reputation for poor transfer quality. Its sister label, Kokomo, specialized in collections by pre-war artists like Buddy Moss and Barbecue Bob. Both managed about 5 album issues, and you can see, initially, their record design was very plain, but after several issues, both opted for cover photos once they discovered that a shot of the entrance to Parchman Prison Farm in Mississippi would pretty much work for any blues record, so only needed to license one. Advent Records issued anthologies in favor of entire EPs or LPs devoted to a single artist. Frank Scott and John Holt began issuing 45s of newly recorded material by Luke and Long Gone Miles on their Two Kings label before expanding into larger projects and then for no reason whatsoever changing their name to Advent. John Lee Hooker and His Guitar, a compilation of early takes and tracks recorded for the Sensation label between 1948 and 1951, sold well enough to ensure the solvency of the concern, which endured into the early 1970s when it became an American record label focusing on newly recorded blues. The Python label was started by Keith Tillman, a former member of the Blues Breakers in the Ainslie-Dunbar retaliation in 1969. And if this were 1969 and we were in Britain, that would mean something to you and be exciting. But despite the presumed cachet of his name, the founder remained anonymous. Many of the releases were repressings of Candid and Cobra albums, and as you can see, handwritten labels and funky pictures very much the norm, but the dubbing on most of the issues was quite bad. Nonetheless, Python was one of the few reissue labels to offer cutting-edge modern blues to the collector market, and sales were sufficient for Tillman to launch 3 subsidiaries. Sunnyland, which had higher production values, extensive liner notes, and artist photos. Post-war blues collector, which managed to make Python Records sound skillfully mastered. And Rebel, which released racist recordings from the American South. In this case, anonymity had its benefits. While the educational aspects of the albums were appreciated, their actual contents, not so much. In 1968, Peter Schuster started his Red Lightning label as, quote, purveyors of contemporary blues, unquote. His first issues in April 1969, was Buddy Guy in the Beginning and Little Walter Quarter to 12. Actually, in the beginning is right there. Double albums of unissued and alternate tracks licensed from Chess. Now, one of the problems with this sort of freewheeling nature of independent labels is that sometimes there were embarrassing overlaps. In 1969, both Red Lightning and Python released LPs by Buddy Guy in the Beginning and The First Time That I Met the Blues, which contained a virtually identical set of unissued and alternate tracks licensed from Chess. Nobody at Chess bothered to tell them they had sold those same tracks to another British label. But sometimes that duplication was by design. Most of the independents pressed only 99 copies of each release in order to circumvent a 33 1/3% purchase tax that was applied to any batches of records intended for commercial sale. So under 99, you were fine. 100, all of a sudden, you're paying 33% tax. So to avoid that, they kept these limited runs. But that meant that if you had a really successful record, it sold out. So sometimes an album that was initially issued on one label might subsequently appear on another. And one example is John Lee Hooker, No Friend Around, which, depending on when and where you ordered it, was either Red Lightning catalog number RL003 or Advent catalog number 2804, both with exactly the same cover. In 1966, John Brovin, the toughest blues critic in Britain for my money, jumped into the reissue business with partner Robert Godson, intending to, quote, present the best and rarest items they can find. Jan and Dill released a handful of items prior to 1968 when they apparently realized that Jan and Dill was a terrible name for a record label and impossible to Google search. Thus, Flywright was born. Its first release was Duke Boy Bonner, the one-man trio, an album that the artist recorded on his personal tape machine at various clubs in Houston. Several anthologies and collections by post-war artists followed. Perhaps the most esteemed reissue label was Pete Brown's Down with the Game, which was devoted to showcasing overlooked talent from the pre-war and immediate post-war periods. His critically acclaimed collections of vintage blues, every single one entitled Down with the Game and differentiated only by volume number, were praised for their superb mastering and track selection. And the anthologies did restore the reputation of more than one artist whose previously available items didn't really reflect their best work. A few aficionados used independent labels to share recordings by their favorite artists. The Blue Circle label, which emerged in 1967, offered it as its apparently only release a 40-track reel-to-reel tape of items by Sam and Beau Chapman. The Sunflower label began when Pete Moody offered a no-label album to accompany his privately published biography of Memphis Minnie, and this is a later pressing on Flywright. The genesis of the Blues Unlimited label, which released only one disc, was a little more elaborate. Columnist Mike Ledbetter asked 200 readers of Blues Unlimited to send $1 to Duke Boy Bonner to pay for a recording session and 1,000 copies of the resulting record, which he hoped would help the blues man relaunch his career. If successful, Ledbetter wrote, other similar schemes may be inaugurated. The resulting single, Blues Unlimited 101, with the unfortunate title Yakin' in My Plans, not only sold several hundred copies beyond those given to donors, but Chris Dravich also heard about the effort and recorded Bonner for Arhuli. But despite its success, the experiment never was repeated. Blue Horizon Records vividly demonstrate the disconnect between the major labels and the burgeoning British blues market. Mike Vernon, who was Decca's blues producer, and his brother Richard launched their concern in early 1965 with a limited edition single that Howlin' Wolf guitarist Hubert Sumlin recorded at their London flat. Apparently, Vernon couldn't convince his own record company that it was worth the studio time. The 99 copies of the disc, offered solely through an ad in R&B Monthly, sold out in 10 days. So the Vernons and their silent partner, Neil Slavin, the editor of R&B Monthly, decided to expand their offerings. Blue Horizon released recordings by visiting blues artists like Lowell Fulson and Snooky Pryor, Houston Boynes and J.B. Lenore, and reissued material by Chicago artists like B.B. King and Otis Rush. Occasionally these were licensed, but most often bootlegged from Cobra and Excello. Blue Horizon also issued a 10-volume Blues Master series, comprised of mostly new material by rediscovered blues artists. Now, for reasons unknown, after releasing three singles on Blue Horizon, the Vernons established the Out of Sight subsidiary, though there was no apparent difference in the type of material or the price. Months later, another Blue Horizon subsidiary was launched, but this time there was a clear need for a new imprint, because Perdah's record or focus was not post-war blues, but British blues. In 1966 and 1967, Vernon released singles by artists like Eric Clapton, Alexis Korner, and the Savoy Brown Blues Band. The success of these releases, which not surprisingly sold more than 99 copies apiece, led to a distribution deal with CBS. After 1967, Blue Horizon concentrated on recording British blues rock groups like Fleetwood Mac and Chicken Shack. And I've really never heard Bacon Fat, but I thought that was a great name for a band. But Blue Horizon did continue to issue post-war material from the U.S. and remained committed to promoting minor blues artists like Champion Jack Dupree. Blue Horizon competed directly with another independent label founded for many of the same reasons. Andrew Lou Goldham, manager of the Rolling Stones, launched Immediate Records to record up-and-coming artists on the London blues and R&B scene. Today, Immediate is remembered primarily for three things. They are the label that signed Small Faces. Two, some excellent British blues appeared on the Immediate label, produced by a young musician just getting started by the name of Jimmy Page, and fraud and embezzlement on a major scale. Blue Horizon and Immediate were not the only independents to promote the British variety of blues. Pete Moody launched Saydisc in 1965 to record folk blues and jazz artists that frequented the Bristol Folk Blues in the West, one of the largest blues clubs in Britain, which Pete Moody co-founded. After releasing a few records, he expanded to a wider variety of music, including bell choirs, pianola, and cylinder recordings. In fact, Saydisc didn't really focus on the blues, British or otherwise, until guitarists Ian A. Anderson and Mike Cooper proposed a quasi-subsidiary named Matchbox to present the, quote, best from all aspects of the country blues. The first Saydisc Matchbox issue, a compilation of British country blues entitled Blues Like Showers of Rain, was largely responsible for mainstreaming contemporary acoustic blues. Both Cooper and Anderson continued to employ Matchbox for their own music, but the label's focus quickly shifted to reissues of American country material. Blind Boy Fuller On Down, a compilation based on a series of articles by Simon Napier in Blues Unlimited, sold more than 1,000 copies upon its release in 1969, and it also cemented the label's reputation for high-quality transfers and informative liner notes. After his No Label Memphis mini album, Pete Moody released four more compilations, like this, No Label, Name, very plain. After four releases, he decided to name this new concern Sunflower Records and went back and assigned catalog numbers to all of his releases. Now, what's really unusual is why he didn't issue any of these on the Saydisc label, which he had already founded and already had a reputation and was already releasing blues, as was Matchbox. But this pales in comparison to the album The Blues Keep Falling, a compilation of post-war blues that took the no-label notion to an entirely new level. Not only was the disc not associated with any of Moody's now three record labels, though collectors still refer to it as a not-quite-Sunflower release, there was no label on the actual record. Rather, stickers were provided so you could label the sides A and B once you had determined which was which based on the track listing on the sleeve. In some ways, phrase, this is the quintessential British independent blues release. Only 75 copies were ever issued. They were only available through the mail from an anonymous source and label, and you had to be in the know to understand it or to identify any of the songs. Now, there are scores of other independent labels from this period about which I have been able to learn nothing. Some, like British Liberty, were associated with American parent companies and then declared their independence and started spinning off subsidiaries, in this case, Minute and Sunset, for no apparent reason whatsoever. They were called budget labels, but the discs cost the same, whether they were on Liberty or on the budgets. Others, like Allegro and Pickwick, may or may not be related to American labels with the same name. Then there are the true one-disc wonders, anonymous and ephemeral, leaving behind only colorful names like African Folk Society, Delta Swing, Floatin' Bridge, and Negro Rhythm, as well as the elusive promise of a really valuable collector's item if you ever find one. There are probably more out there, somewhere, the unheralded participants of an unlikely market and revival. And before anything else, I do want to thank my unacknowledged or my unknowing collaborator, this guy, Stefan Wirtz of Hanover, Germany, and you can see him here as he is now and playing bass in a German blues band in 1967. This guy has a huge blues collection, a scanner, a penchant for discography, and apparently a lot of free time. Almost all of the images here are from his website. If you're ever doing anything with the British blues or blues re-releases, great discographies, photos, you can usually click and read liner notes or at least the back of the album, so I do want to acknowledge him as well. Thank you.
Actually, I want to, sorry.
Go ahead.
I would like to offer a thank you because now I understand something about a record I once collected. It was a Say Disc LP,
mm-hmm.
and it was trad, okay, not blues, but trad. But I have no idea what it was because all it had was a label that said Say Disc and no other information whatsoever.
No. Not unusual.
Were there also shops at the time, like in London now, with white label shops for dance music?
There were tons of shops. In fact, that was sort of... Yeah, those were really sort of where the blues revival got started. There was a very limited number of shops in early 1960, and that's really where, you know, all of the British blues players and blues rock players really met was fighting over Charlie Patton albums. None. None of these are in my archive. I should make that clear. Yes?
Yeah, we're fortunate. We have quite a few of the later pressings at Bowling Green because we started in 67, and I started hitting the record list, but one of my favorite Satanists is the one called Dance Till the Break of Dawn, which is a reissue of early ragtime and minstrel, one of the first records that had a reissue of old, you know, minstrel.
Yeah, I think that was Say Disc number 2. I mean, it was one of the very earliest releases.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could tell us something about the subsequent history of some of these labels. I'm interested particularly in Flyrite. Mm-hmm. I used to work as a buyer for a record store in Chicago from late 70s through the late 80s. And Flyrite was around a good long time and had quite an extensive catalog. Do you know what's become of the label and... you know, just give us some subsequent history on it or any of the other survivors.
Okay, I think Bruce Baston is still in charge of Say Disc. I think it's become Say Disc, Matchbox, Flyrite, Crazy Cat, Traveling Man, and Charlie. I think those are all...
It's
sort of... Is he? Okay, then I don't know. But I know he had them for a while, and it's Interstate Music Limited. It was the last sort of name that I had for all of those, but it might be dead now.
Okay,
talk to Bruce.
Your ultimate bootleg disc leads me to ask the question, in your opinion, having reviewed these, to what degree were such things as plain jackets, lack of catalog numbers, obscure addresses, lack of identifiers as to the source, how much of that was for rational reasons such as tax, copyright, and how much of it was just was the originators making cultural statements, libertarian or communist or anti-capitalist type cultural statements?
I doubt that they were cultural statements. I really, of the independent label ads that I've seen, I think probably 2 out of 100 mentioned the founder or listed any personal name at all. Either that was an important thing for you to attach to an advertisement, or like I said, I think conflict of interest was probably a major contributor, since it was so many of the same people who were writing and reviewing and, you know, involved with all aspects of the record business, that maybe wasn't a great idea that you publicly be the face of a label as well. Yes?
And if you could only manufacture 99 copies, and, you know, you only had just so much of an investment in, especially if everyone at the time knew who you were and where to find you, that information was not important at the time.
And like I said, privacy might also have been an issue because British blues fans were vicious, very vicious in print, so very passionate people. Yes. Well, thank you.